Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Thanks so much for being here, everybody. There's so much in the world to cover. Turmoil at home with people standing up to genocide on college campuses across the country. So inspiring. And of course, because people are displaying humanity and a sense of justice, they are facing a vicious crackdown. And we're going to try to cover that as much as we can on today's show, along with all the other horrors in the world that these brave people on campuses are protesting, primarily the genocide in Gaza.
Also, happy Passover to everyone. A lot of people, I think, are struggling with how to talk about what's happening in the world at their seders. I had a cool experience Tuesday night. I anchored a Jewish Voice for Peace seder protest. It was called Seder in the Streets, and that was really fun and a nice way to express solidarity with the people of Gaza and of Palestine. And a lot of Jews got arrested on the streets protesting.
It was a beautiful sight. It was a beautiful sight.
So somehow these protests, which are called anti-Semitic, are being attended, participated in, and in some cases organized by and led by Jews.
Funny how that works.
Yeah, very funny how that works, yeah. Do you have a good Passover Seder, Aaron?
I did have a good Passover Seder. It was very lively. And the theme is liberation. It's pretty topical when the state that claims to act in the name of the Jewish people is suppressing the freedom of a whole people, the Palestinians, with a genocide. And so, of course, there's so much to discuss when it comes to that.
Everyone, enjoy your matzah and good luck with the finding the afikomen, those of you who play that game where you hide the matzah.
All right. Well, we are not hiding the great content because we have so much of it in our four basic food groups. So for Democrats suck, we're going to turn to this recent vote that just happened in Congress. After a long delay, the House passed a $95 billion, quote, foreign aid bill, which really is a war-mongering, war-profiteering bill. Tens of billions of dollars going to Israel, the Ukraine proxy war, and Taiwan to counter China. And pretty much the entire bipartisan establishment united behind it. There was a handful of Republicans who voted no for both Ukraine and Israel funding. But otherwise, this bill passed overwhelmingly. And President Biden, after he signed the bill, came out and called it a victory for world peace.
It's a good day for America. It's a good day for Europe. And it's a good day for world peace, for real. This is consequential. I just signed into law the national security package that was passed by the House of Representatives this weekend and by the Senate yesterday. It's going to make America safer. It's going to make the world safer. And it continues America's leadership in the world, and everyone knows it.
So I think someone only as demented as Joe Biden could sign a bill authorizing tens of billions of dollars for weapons to fuel these horrible wars and, in the case of Israel, a genocide abroad, and say that this is a victory for world peace.
It's almost like Joe Biden is hosting our show and being sarcastic, except he's being sincere.
Some Democrats righteously stood up and voted against the Israel component of this, and they deserve credit for that. I know it's very hard to do that, especially when you have the power of AIPAC spending tens of millions of dollars to defeat anybody who dares stand up to Israel. But on the Ukraine funding, which is $60 billion to prolong this proxy war, every single Democrat voted in favor. The entire squad, the entire Progressive Caucus. And recall, these are the same people who not that long ago signed a letter asking President Biden to engage in diplomacy with Russia to end the Ukraine war. And they withdrew that after 24 hours, after a neocon freakout, and they haven't raised the issue since. And now Biden goes and asks them for $60 billion to keep the war going, through his reelection campaign at least, and they all give their assent. And so Michael Tracy made a list of everybody who actually voted no consistently, who voted against both the Ukraine funding and the Israel funding, and it's only Republicans on that list, and it's only a very small amount of people. It's 21 people.
Wow.
There it is. So not one Democrat.
That's so crazy.
Even Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is like a hardcore supporter of Israel and its mass murder campaign in Gaza, even she voted against funding Israel and giving it more weapons. There's no Democrat who could say the same thing.
It's so depressing. It's so embarrassing. And then people say, oh, this is a right-wing thing to oppose funding Ukraine is right-wing. If you're a leftist, you should support it. And of course, no, the point is that we should not be outflanked on this issue by Republicans.
No, we should not. Now, here is Bernie Sanders, who did vote against the measure, to his credit. He's one of the few Democrats in the Senate who actually, well, he's not officially a Democrat, but he's one of the few members of the Democratic. Yeah, yeah. But even in the process, he tried to explain that he supports most of the funding that he voted against, just not some of it. And so this is what Bernie said.
I strongly support getting Ukraine the military aid it needs to defend itself against Putin's imperialist war. I support the Iron Dome to protect Israeli civilians from missile and drone attacks. But let me be very clear. I strongly support ending the provision which will give $8.9 billion in unfettered offensive military aid to the extremist Israeli government.
Michael Tracy made this point that Bernie is saying that out of a $95 billion war funding bill, Bernie opposes approximately $9 billion of that. And that was enough to get him to vote against it. And good for him. It's, you know, like I salute him for it. But it's just so funny that even an opponent of this war funding measure has to go out of their way to say that they support most of what they voted against. And that's the climate in Washington right now. You have to pay lip service to war funding. And if you don't, you're somehow seen as an appeaser of Putin, an appeaser of Hamas. And but that's the best we can hope for right now from progressives in Congress.
I just don't get it. It's like if they cared about Ukrainians, they'd want to contain this war that Ukrainians are losing.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, we've made this point a lot that they've already poured tens of billions of dollars into this war. That led to a Ukrainian counteroffensive that was a massive failure. So just even putting aside all the lost chances for diplomacy before the war, after it began with the talks in Istanbul in early 2022 that were essentially blocked by the US and the UK. Even putting that aside, just like militarily, we've already poured so much money in. Ukraine's still lost about 20% of its territory. The counteroffensive was a disaster. So how will $60 billion possibly turn the tide? It's just, according to everything that's gone so far, it's just a death sentence for more people, especially Ukrainians. But you can't even talk about the possibility of diplomacy right now in Washington. It's that letter that was surfaced for 24 hours. It's like it didn't even exist from the progressives. It's just gone. And now all you have to do is bow down and give Joe Biden more money to prolong this war.
It's awful.
Now, at least Bernie Sanders voted against this measure. This is Ed Markey, who spoke out very eloquently on the Senate floor against another major component of this bill, which is banning TikTok. And the reasons are very clear for that, as we've covered before on the show. And we also cover in this week's Thursday Throwdown, which is available for your split subscribers. They want to ban TikTok because it's allowing messaging and content that supports Palestinian rights and opposes the Israeli genocide. And therefore, the proponents of this ban have openly said that's a major reason why they want to ban TikTok. Ed Markey gets up on the floor and says that this is censorship. This is wrong. But yet, guess what? He went and voted for it anyway. So this is what Ed Markey said.
This legislation may address or at least mitigate a national security risk, but it could and likely will result in widespread censorship. And this censorship would predominantly impact young people in our country, many of whom are just gaining their political consciousness. We should be very clear about the likely outcome of this law. It's really just a TikTok ban. And once we properly acknowledge that this bill is a TikTok ban, we can better see its impact on free expression. 170 million users, 170 million Americans use TikTok. And American history has too many examples of controversial laws that ultimately infringe on civil liberties in the name of national security.
Wow. So stirring. And then he goes ahead and votes right for the censorship that he just denounced. So that's Democrats right now.
It's do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's Democrats suck.
So for Republicans suck, let's take a look at the great Senator Tom Cotton, who last week was calling for physical violence against protesters. Let's hear what he had to say about students protesting at Columbia and NYU.
that if Eric Adams won't send the NYPD to protect these Jewish students, if Kathy Hochul won't send the National Guard, Joe Biden has a duty to protect these Jewish students from what is a nascent pogrom on these campuses. These are scenes like you've seen out of the 1930s in Germany. They should never be witnessed or tolerated here in America in 2024.
Yeah, you know what we saw in 1930s Germany that reminds me a lot of 1930s Germany is Jews out on the street celebrating Shabbat, Jews celebrating Pesach. These are just two of the things that Jews protesting at Columbia and NYU were doing. They were actively engaging in public prayer, expressing their Judaism, just like they used to do in 1930s Germany, when all those Jews would be outside in the streets, both protesting and praying and celebrating Shabbat and Passover. He's such a good student of history, Mr. Cotton.
He's such an insane racist that he sees, you know, Palestinian-led protests, Muslim-led protests against genocide, and he sees that as somehow akin to Nazis.
Right.
When, of course, if you're going to draw an analogy, it's Israel right now that are the Nazis, you know, committing mass murder in a death right. camp.
Yeah, they're the ones engaging in pogroms.
Exactly. I mean, you know, and exactly as you said, there are, you know, there have been Jewish services amidst all these protests. There was one in Brooklyn the other night outside Chuck Schumer's house, and there was one on the Columbia campus.
Right.
There was a really, there was a Shabbat, a Sabbath, and also a Passover gathering too amidst all these protests. What can you say about these people? It's crazy. And it's so offensive. I mean, even if you're someone who's like a Zionist and a bigot who doesn't care about Palestinian rights, how can you allow for the memory of the Nazi Holocaust to be demeaned like that? You know, even if you don't agree with these protests,
right?
How can you let someone compare them
to the Nazi Holocaust? Right. Regardless of your views on this, don't you have the decency to see that a protest, even if it's calling for something you may not like, can't you see that a protest doing that attended by Jews is not akin to the Holocaust? I mean, it's also so stunning because as of now, we've had in the follow-up to Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza, we've had one Palestinian child stabbed to death. His mother was stabbed and survived. And we've had Palestinian students shot, three Palestinian students shot, one of whom is now paralyzed for life. And yet the discourse around safety is only about Jews.
Yeah.
It's just so obviously political, one-sided, not about protecting minorities. So that's not the only great thing that Tom Cotton has to say about these protesters. He has another idea. Let's take a look at Tom Cotton expressing more of his freedom of speech.
I gather there were about 100 people arrested last night at NYU. It seems like there may need to be even more arrests today. These university presidents need to ask the mayor and the chief of police in New York to send in New York City's finest to arrest anyone who's breaking the law, who's squatting on private property when they've been told to disperse, who's harassing or intimidating Jewish students in a nascent pogrom, and demand that students...
He really likes that term. You see, he uses, again, a nascent pogrom.
Actually do what they're supposed to do on campus, which is go to school. And by the way, any of these students who are foreigners here on visas should immediately have their visas revoked by the Biden administration and be promptly deported. They have no right to be here. They certainly have no right to be here spewing anti-Semitic and anti-Israel filth.
Yes, thank you. Tom Cotton, you clearly care about people's rights, safety, feelings, and that's why you're calling to deport people with views you disagree with.
I mean, meanwhile, Biden is calling these protests out. He's denouncing them. Like the White House had a horrible statement about the Columbia protests. But then again, like you compare how awful Biden is to then someone like Tom Cotton calling for deporting students and sending the National Guard. Right. These are our choices. It's so depressing.
It's so depressing.
It's so depressing.
Well, Aaron, if you wanted another example of the odious monsters who run this country, let's take a look at what Senator Ted Cruz had to say about Biden's response to protesters at Yale, Columbia, and NYU.
Listen, what we're seeing at universities is absolutely horrific. This anti-Semitism, this hatred, this violence, these threats directed at Jewish students should be utterly unacceptable. At Columbia University, the Orthodox rabbi advised Jewish students, go home and stay home because the university will not protect your safety. Columbia.
By the way, that rabbi is involved with the World Zionist Organization, just so you know. And the Columbia Hillel said, no, don't do that. We're still open.
Yeah. And that rabbi also, you know, as part of his ties to Zionist groups, he also has ties to settler groups in the occupied right. West Bank. So yeah. That's who we're talking about here. That's who we're relying on here as the protector of Jewish people, someone who supports the terrorizing Palestinian people in the occupied West Bank.
Right. Oh, so maybe he's like, go home, go make Aliyah, go to Israel, go settle. Maybe that's what he means. Could be.
The university also barred one of its own professors, a Jewish professor, from coming on campus because they concluded they would not protect his safety. And understand, these administrators and many of these faculty.
He's referring to Shai Davidai, right?
Yeah.
The guy who harasses Muslim students constantly.
Yeah, constantly doxes them while himself going to unauthorized protests, which is interesting. Oh, yeah. He's very histrionic and loves social media attention and media attention. Yeah. And he wanted to be able to basically mount his own counter protest with police protection. And Columbia was like, no, we're not going to do that for you.
Members side with the radicals. We saw an image this weekend of presumably a Columbia student, and by the way, by all appearances, not a Palestinian, but a young blonde woman, standing there with an Arab headscarf and holding a sign, and she's standing in front of several Jewish students behind her who have Israeli flags and American flags, and her sign says Al-Qassam's next target with an arrow at these Jewish students. Al-Qassam is Hamas's military arm. She is literally advocating that terrorists murder her fellow students.
So that woman, that blonde woman, by the way, and this is an issue, which is that they're often agent provocateurs, people posing as protesters who are actually on the other side. No one seems to know where this woman comes from. She doesn't seem to be, she's not part of any group. She's not chanting with other people. I would be very surprised if she were not someone who's actually trying to discredit the pro-Palestine activists.
Well, let's watch the video because it's interesting. They filmed this woman with that sign, but yet nobody confronted her, which I find very strange. Yeah. So let's watch a clip. So for our audio audience, what that shows there is a blonde woman whose face is covered with a keffiyeh holding up a sign saying Al-Qassam's next targets as she stands in front of some presumably Jewish students waving the Israeli flag and singing some Israeli songs or Hebrew songs. But yet, so they filmed her, but yet nobody confronted her and said, hey, you're encouraging violence against these students. And by the way, also, she spells Al-Qassam wrong. I don't know. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it's just something to point out that she doesn't even spell Al-Qassam properly.
Right.
So I don't know. I agree. I do not trust any of these people. I mean, we've seen so many times how the Israeli government and its supporters have lied through their teeth to justify the genocide. So I don't give them the benefit of the doubt here. Why are they not confronting someone who's calling for their death? Just seems a little bit too convenient. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if this was an agent provocateur.
Right. And they've been calling, there have been tweets where we've been seeing people looking for people who can pass as Muslim, as they say, pass as Palestinian. There have been tweets online asking people to blend in and be infiltrators. And yeah, why didn't they try to call the police if they really thought there was a call for violence? That seems like an easy target.
Okay, well, isn't that weird? Here is someone who is not an infiltrator, I think. I think this is the real deal. And it's so funny. A couple went to a protest at Yale University and thought they were being brave by having one of them write the word Jew on her shirt and walk into a crowd of pro-Palestinian protesters. And they walked around, I think, assuming there'd be some sort of reaction, but basically everybody doesn't even notice them because actually protesters are not there to protest Jews. They're there to protest genocide. And that doesn't clue in to these people. So watch what happens.
Thank you.
for our audio audience, she's standing there. Her shirt says Jew and Israel and has a Star of David on the shirt. And she's standing there, you know, with a very serious look on her face while everyone else is just like hanging out. There's some dancing going on. No one even cares that she's there. But I think in the minds of these people, they think this is some brave act of defiance to, you know, show that they're Jewish, not understanding that people there don't care about whether you're Jewish or not. They care whether you support a genocide being waged in the name of the Jewish people. And I'm sure that crowd includes many Jewish people who are opposed to genocide. In fact, right behind her right now, we can see there's a sign saying Jews for a free Palestine. So there you go.
Somehow they're safe enough to have a sign that says that they're Jewish. So, yeah, it's wonderful. This is a great, actually, advertisement for how these protests are not anti-Semitic, because no one cares that this person is Jewish. No one targets this person as being Jewish. But I like the fact that the person who tweeted this out wrote, "My wife is a brave Jew. We stood alone at Yale University today. She wore no mask and was proud. Notice the horde hiding behind their masks." And the reason a lot of people are wearing masks, by the way, is because they don't want to get doxxed. They don't want to wind up on Canary Mission's website. But the woman, to her credit, this brave Jew was far from silent.
"I am not afraid. Look at my face. I am not afraid. Put my face on camera.
Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it to be selling. Yeah.
Dox me. Yeah. You know, she's challenging the Palestinian lobby that gets people fired.
Yeah.
That's so brave of her. Wow.
It's rare you see someone so desperate to be like hated. Like she's like saying like, "Hate, dox me, hate me. Feel the, I want to feel your hate." Like she doesn't understand that they don't have hate. She has the hate.
Right. You know?
And it's not being reciprocated. So it's confusing.
Well, isn't that terrible? Let's take a break from all the terrible stuff that's happening in the United States and, of course, in Gaza. And let's take a look at a story about a Lithuanian man who has an interesting trick. He lives in Alicante, Spain. He's from Lithuania. And he has an interesting way that he avoids paying for his meals. He would order his food and then feign having a heart attack. Here, the New York Post writes, "Lithuanian man arrested for faking heart attack 20 times to avoid paying bills at restaurants." And he's sadly been arrested. He ordered paella most recently and two whiskeys and then feigned having a heart attack. He said he felt unwell and threw himself on the ground. And the restaurant's owner, where it happened most recently in Spain, said it was very theatrical. He pretended to faint and slumped himself down on the floor.
You just have to admire the commitment. You know, that's called commitment to a bit. I wish I could have witnessed one of these fake heart attacks, because he's obviously gotten away with, he's obviously pretty good at it.
A very weird part, I have to say, about this article is that, and again, this is the New York Post, so they don't do the best journalism. The 50-year-old man, a Lithuanian national identified as Aidas J, lives in the southeastern port city of Alicante and has acted like a, quote, typical Russian tourist, end quote, while he ordered several items off the menu before refusing to pay the bill. It doesn't attribute that quote about typical Russian tourist, but I'm not sure what that's a reference to. Do Russians typically order a lot and not pay, or do Russians typically order a lot and then fake a heart attack? Very unclear.
Great question. Yeah. I don't recall coming across a Russian tourist faking a heart attack. So,
but Aaron, that could be straight out of the RPB, from the Russian playbook. Yeah.
The classic Russian playbook.
The classic Russian playbook. Yeah.
Add another one. God, that's when we finally publish the Russian playbook.
Yeah. We got to put that in there.
Volume. It's going to be a very thick volume because there's so many tactics in there.
It's going to include post eating feigned heart attack.
There you go.
Bill evasion. Yeah. So that's been your four basic food groups. It's been a while, but we have a stone moment for you. So, boy, oh boy, is this a good stone moment. Let's take a listen to what Joe Biden had to say while speaking in Scranton.
And I can't, well, when I left Scranton today, I wanted to go to the war memorial that has the names of all the Scrantonians who died in World War II etched into a granite wall, because I wanted to see where my uncle Bosie Ambrose J. Finnegan, where his name was etched, back in when D-Day occurred. And on Sunday, the next day, my mother's four brothers all went down to the recruiting station and joined the military. Every one of them volunteered. And my uncle, they called him Ambrose, Brosie, they called him Bosie. My uncle Bosie was a hell of an athlete, they tell me when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there used to be there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
So there you have Joe Biden suggesting that his uncle may have been eaten by cannibals. And Karine Jean-Pierre, Biden's spokeswoman, has the unfortunate job of being Biden's spokeswoman and also had the unfortunate job of having to respond to his statements.
I do have to ask you about a different topic.
Oh.
Why is President Biden saying that his uncle Bosie was eaten by cannibals?
So, you know, I answered this question yesterday. I believe.
By the way, can you imagine, do you think Karine Jean-Pierre ever envisioned that her career would include having to field questions about why Biden said his uncle was eaten by cannibals?
You know, if ever there's a biopic of Karine Jean-Pierre, they got to call it Don't Look Up.
Yeah.
Because she just does not look up. She can't.
Can you blame her?
Yeah, it's a tough job.
Yeah.
I've seen some clips on your network about me answering this question. I don't have much to say beyond what I said to some of your colleagues. Look, I was there. I think you traveled with us, too, to Pennsylvania. I'm not sure if you were there at the memorial in Scranton. The president had a emotional and I think a symbolic moment. He had an opportunity as president to honor his uncle's service in uniform. He had an opportunity to be there as president to speak to the bravery of his uncle, and not just his uncle, but many U.S. service members that put their lives on the line on behalf of this country. So his uncle, who lost his life when the military aircraft he was on crashed in the Pacific after taking off near New Guinea, the president highlighted his uncle's story as he made the case for honoring our sacred commitment to equip those we send to war and take care of them and their families when they come home. And as he iterated, the last thing American veterans are, or the last thing Americans are, should be called, are suckers and losers. And that is, those types of words should not come from a commander in chief, as we have in the past. And we should actually be lifting up our American veterans and honoring them. And that's what you saw from this president.
And I agree. Second Lieutenant Ambrose J. Finnegan was a war hero. But the Pentagon says, for unknown reasons, the plane was forced to ditch in the ocean. Both engines failed at low altitude. Why is President Biden saying he was shot down? There's no evidence of that. And why is he saying that his uncle was eaten by cannibals? That is a bad way to go.
He lost his life. It's not, look, I'm not, we should not make jokes about
it's
this.
Not, oh, wait. President Biden said that his uncle was eaten by cannibals.
I mean, your last line, it's for a laugh. It's for a funny statement. And
it's what Biden said.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what Biden said. And it is funny. I mean, but it's not the questioner's fault that it's funny.
Right. Well, she's saying that when he said it's a bad way to go, that was a laugh line. I don't think he was saying that necessarily as a laugh line. I think people had to laugh because the whole thing is so ridiculous. Yeah. I like the way she called it a symbolic moment, though, for Biden. Maybe that's what we should be calling our stone moments, symbolic moments.
Yeah. And of course, they have to bring it back to Trump.
Yeah. So their answer literally is but Trump, and it's not funny. And he got emotional. So you know, Biden, he got emotional. He had to lie that he was shot down and also lie about him being eaten by cannibals.
Yeah. Well, lest you think that Biden is off of his game, I have some news for you. This president is sharp. He's totally with it, as evidenced by this rousing call for his reelection.
Imagine what we can do next. Four more years. Pause.
Four more years. Pause. Four more years. Four more years.
Let's do that one more time.
Four more years. Pause.
Four more years. Pause.
What does he say? Four more years.
Pause. He's reading pause. From his script, his teleprompter script. Four more years. Pause. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah.
So we definitely have a stone president. And awkward moments for Karine Jean-Pierre, his poor press secretary. I mean, unfortunately, it's hard to have empathy for her because her job entails, for example, justifying his support for mass murder in Gaza.
Right.
But she does have a hard job. And again, that's why she just cannot look up from the podium.
Right.
It's the strangest thing. She can't. I'm sure someone talks to her about it, but it's so difficult to lie to defend that guy always that she just can't do it. She can't look up.
Right. All right. That's been your stone moment. We are so excited to be welcoming to the show Jamie Stern Weiner, Coulter Lewis, and Ahmed Alnaouk. And Jamie edited this great book called Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. And Coulter is a contributor and Ahmed is a contributor. So we're going to be talking to all of them about this book, but also on a larger level about what is happening right now in Gaza. Thank you guys so much for joining. And thank you for this great book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Jamie, you edited this book, you put it together. What was your motivation and what are you arguing overall in this book?
Well, it was clear pretty quickly after the magnitude of the Hamas-led ground invasion on October 7th was reported. It was obvious this was going to be a historic kind of turning point in the conflict. And I also felt that many people were likely to be ill-equipped to understand how it came to be, not through any fault of their own, but because Western media, on which people understandably rely on to make sense of these events, in the years leading up to October 2023, had basically let not just the plight of the people of Gaza, but the Palestine question writ large fall from the agenda. And the reason for that is fairly simple, if not very flattering. In those years, only Palestinians were dying from periodic massacres. In those years, only Palestinians were being deliberately immiserated and reduced to penury by an illegal siege. And unfortunately, when Palestinian suffering is not accompanied by suffering of people who matter, like Israelis, or when it doesn't come with regional or global geopolitical turbulence, Western precincts tend to just ignore it. And so I felt that for many people, the attack on October 7th, it was likely to have come out of the blue, to seem as if it was just a bolt from a clear blue sky. And so the main purpose of the book, which I edited, was to place those events on October 7th, and then, of course, the genocidal Israeli onslaught, which has unfolded since, in context. Because so far from being kind of erupting from a vacuum, in truth, both the Hamas attack and what followed, they're the, in many respects, predictable consequence of longstanding injustices and conditions which Israel, enabled by the US and other key allies, quite consciously engineered. So to give just, you know, a few instances, back in 1948, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were expelled to make way for the establishment of the State of Israel, some 250,000 fled to Gaza. Most of the population of Gaza today, some 70%, they're refugees from that expulsion and their descendants. Fast forward to 1967, Israel annexes, effectively annexes Gaza, but refuses to extend political rights to its inhabitants, which means that for above a half century, the people in Gaza have been living with their lives subject to foreign military rule with no prospect for that being brought to an end. Fast forward to a more proximate background to the current catastrophe. 2006, after Hamas wins free and fair elections. How does the international community and Israel respond? Well, if you listen to John Dugard, currently heading South Africa's legal team at the ICJ, back then he was UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory. He said that the international community responded to Hamas's electoral victory by imposing upon the Palestinians possibly the most rigorous set of international sanctions in modern times. He also noted, parenthetically, that whereas Western powers in the 1980s had justified their opposition to sanctions on apartheid South Africa on the grounds that this would cause suffering for the black population of South Africa, no such consideration was extended to the occupied people of Palestine. So since 2006, there's been this illegal, inhuman economic blockade that's just completely destroyed the economy in Gaza and reduced the population to dependence on food aid for survival. And then on top of that, on top of dispossession, annexation, siege, there've been the periodic Israeli massacres visited on Gaza every few years, what Israeli officials call mowing the lawn, intended to keep the inmates of that open-air prison in Gaza in line. And while the scale of those massacres has unfortunately pales in comparison to the outright genocide that's now being perpetrated, they were quite devastating. And when you add all that up, when you put that together, you understand that basically when you understand what the situation in Gaza was like on October 6th, October 7th really shouldn't come as a surprise, except for the technical feat that was achieved in overcoming those Israeli perimeter defenses. And so really the main task of the book was to situate the present catastrophe in that long historical context. In addition, I also wanted the book to show that there were many, many, you could say, off-ramps which could have been taken, which, if pursued, would have led us in a direction and to destinations far less miserable than the place we now find ourselves. And Coulter's chapter, which we'll talk about in particular, documents just how many of those diplomatic off-ramps there were, and how many Israel and the US spurned and sabotaged, systematically refused to take. The final task that I wanted to accomplish with the book is there are aspects of what's happened since October 7th, which are genuinely new. Of course, it builds on longstanding structures and injustices of the kind I described. But there are genuinely new aspects, both depressing, but also hopeful. We can talk about some of them perhaps in this discussion, but part of the book is given over to providing an initial analysis of those.
Ahmed, you are the co-founder of the group We Are Not Numbers, based in Gaza. Tell us how that group came about and what you wrote about in this book, Deluge.
And also condolences to you for what happened to your family.
Thank you very much. So yeah, We Are Not Numbers, a project is started in 2015. It actually happened after the Israeli war in Gaza in 2014. In that war, I lost my brother and many of my friends to the Israeli bombardment. And then I was encouraged by an American journalist to write a story about my brother. At first, I hesitated, and I talked about this in the book, in my chapter in the book. I hesitated to write a story about my brother because in my mind, I was only 19 years old, and I thought that the West don't care about Palestine. They don't want to hear our stories, and they view us as all we are terrorists and all of that. I was encouraged nonetheless to write my story about my brother in English. And then she helped me edit my story, edit the language, the English language. And then we published the story. After we published the story, something had changed in me in a sense that I realized that some people can care about Palestine in the West, that some Americans, some British people can care about Palestine. Some people do want to hear our stories. Some people want to read our stories. So that made me feel better that the Palestinians are not voiceless. The Palestinians can speak and some people can and want to listen to the Palestinians. So that story that I wrote about my brother encouraged and inspired the creation of a platform for youth and refugees in Gaza, young people in Gaza, to write their stories in English with the help of international mentors who helped them their stories. That's how we started in 2015, training 20 writers from Gaza with their English language, with how to write their stories, and then pairing them with international mentors to help them write their stories in English. So yeah, we have been working ever since. We have recruited more than 400 writers. We published hundreds of stories on our website, so you can read all of them. And actually, when Jamie asked me to write a chapter in this book about my life or about whatever I want to, I said, okay, we are not numbers as a storytelling, and I'd like to consider myself as a storyteller. I like to tell stories. So I said, the most powerful thing would be to write my own story. And not only my story as Ahmad, as someone who lost his family in this war, because as you know, Jamie actually reached out to me after he heard that I lost all my family in Gaza in this bombardment. But I said, I want to tell the story of my family, the story of my father, even beyond before this war. So I started from the day that my father was born in 1948. My father was 75 years old, and he was born only a few months after the Nakba to refugees' parents. And I said that on the first day that my father was born in Deir el-Balah in Gaza, his grandfather and his brother were targeted and they were killed in Deir el-Balah. And that was a massacre in Deir el-Balah that only a few people would know, a few people would remember in Deir el-Balah. If you search it, if you look it up in history, maybe you will not find much information about it. And that Deir el-Balah was in the Gaza Strip. And his grandfather was in the market when Israel dropped a bomb that killed 150 people in that market. One of them my grandfather, or my father's grandfather. So I started from that day. I started from the Nakba, because some people, as Jamie just illustrated, that in the West, in the Western media, the story of Palestine now is talked a lot. It's talked a lot about, but only in the starting point would be the 7th of October, as if all of this struggle, the fighting, the massacres of the Palestinians, the suffering of the Palestinian, it started as a result of Hamas acts. But they never tell the stories behind that, the 75 years or more of suffering of the Palestinian people. I talked about how my grandfather was killed in 1948, how we lived as refugees in the Gaza Strip, how my father did not have that, although he was one of the smartest people I know. He has a photographic memory. He spoke many languages, but he couldn't go to university because of the closure of the borders and because of the war. So I talked about the human stories behind the massacre that happened to my family. I talked about my father, the suffering and the trauma that he had to endure while he was forced to work in Israel as a laborer. And that's very part of the story is that very big part of the story is that the Palestinians in the 70s and 80s and the 90s were forced to work as laborers in Israel because that was the only option to work and to earn income for your family. And then I talked about my life when I was born in 1948, and we thought that peace process that will happen. I talked about the Second Intifada, the Second Intifada, and the many, many wars that happened, my life under occupation, my life under siege, the lack of movement, and my life as a young person in Gaza. I also talked about the wars that Israel launched on Gaza in 2008, 2014, 2019, 2021, and all of that. And I meant to talk, so it was my chapter was a story about myself, a story about my family, a story about my father. And I believe that when people read this story, they will understand the question of Palestine from reading a story, because my story is just an example of what's actually going on. It's just a microcosm
Can you share some of that story for people who haven't read the book? And of course, I encourage everyone to read it, but can you just give people a sense of it?
What happened to my family is what happened to more than 2,000 Palestinian families in Gaza. They were sleeping in their home in the south of the Gaza Strip when it was said that the south is safe. My family were sleeping in their home. My father, my two brothers, my three sisters, my 14 nieces and nephews, they were just sleeping in their home at dawn when Israel dropped a bomb on my family and they killed them all. This is what happened, just like that. And that's the title of my chapter, just like that. They killed my entire family, erased my entire family, massacred my entire family, just like that. They killed three women, an old man, my father, and 14 children, 14 kids under the age of 13, just like that. And this Israeli, this army knew exactly who lives in this house. It was a safe area. It was in the heart of Deir el-Balah. There are no fighters around. There are no missiles going around. There is no like a ground invasion at that time in October. They just bombed the home, killed everyone without a sense of accountability. They knew that they can get away with it. They knew that. They killed my family. They killed other 2,000 families. And now by every passing day, we hear more and more of the Israeli massacres. In Ashifa Hospital, we found a massive grave. In Nasser Hospital, 300 people were buried under the hospital. It was like they're acting with impunity. Like I don't know how to describe it, but how did we reach a point in which a state can massacre entire families with their kids, with the parents, with the grandparents, just like that, without any accountability, with impunity? And this is what happened to my family, and this is what happened to many, 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 many other families, hundreds of families. They are just killing us, just like that. And I believe they enjoy killing us. This is how I understand it. They enjoy killing the Palestinians.
And of course, one of the members or one of the mentors of We Are Not Numbers was Rifat Al-Arir, who was also targeted and killed by Israel.
Him and his family, and he was targeted for a joke that he wrote on Twitter.
Right.
So you see. And we also lost other four members of We Are Not Numbers. Four of our writers were killed, including my brother. My brother was a writer for We Are Not Numbers. He was a human rights defender. He worked in human rights his entire life. He was a peaceful, kind, lovely young man who got scholarship to do his master's in Australia in international relations. When I asked him, why do you want to study that? He said he wanted to be a diplomat. He wanted to be a diplomat. And then he just killed like that, so...
There's two brief comments I'd like just to make about that, if I may. Firstly, I thought that the refrain in the chapter, just like that, is very appropriate because it conveys that the population of Gaza, it's been left to live and all too often to die at the whim, at the caprice, and on the arbitrary decision-making power of a hostile foreign military over which those 2 million people, including 1 million children, have got no say whatsoever. And when you combine that with the impunity that's been afforded to that military by the United States, by Europe, and by what's called the international community, it shouldn't surprise when they exercise it in the manner of how a slave owner abuses a slave, how anyone behaves when people are entirely subject to their whim. The other point I'd want to make is that Yaniv Kogan, an Israeli researcher who also contributes a chapter to the book, he quotes a guy called Dan Shiftan. He's a official at the NSSC, which is kind of like a security quasi, you know, very close to the IDF defense think tank in Israel, also affiliated to the University of Haifa. Dan Shiftan's been an advisor to multiple Israeli prime ministers. He said, I think it was in 2018, when he was talking about the significance of Israeli ground invasions. What's the significance of them? He said, of course, we come up with a pretext. We want to root out Hamas. We want to degrade Hamas military infrastructure. We want to go after Hamas. But the real significance is the devastation we leave behind. The real significance is the devastation we leave behind. And the rest, he said, we have to say for the sake of those international law people. But as long as we understand, meaning Israeli soldiers and officials, as long as we understand the real purpose, it's the devastation we leave behind.
Coulter, your chapter is called "Is Hamas to Blame for the Failure to Resolve the Israel-Palestine Conflict?" And you quote Israel's one-time foreign minister, Abba Eban, who famously said, "The Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace." So what is it that you are arguing in your chapter?
Well, just to kind of reiterate what you said, in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th attacks and then on repeat, continuing to the very present, we've heard that it's impossible to negotiate an independent Palestinian state, certainly impossible to negotiate one with Hamas, because this is an organization that is effectively the equivalent of Al-Qaeda, of ISIS, or of the Nazis, or in some cases, perhaps even it's worse than the Nazis, because it's dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish state and Jews in Palestine. And exactly as you said, I recognized when beginning the chapter that these kind of claims are, you know, they're old hat. The foreign minister, Abba Eban, famously said that the Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace. And that, too, has been elevated into a kind of ubiquitous mantra amongst pro-Israel types. So what I decided to do is just look at the historical record and see if that's the case. And what one finds when one looks at the historical record is that the historical record completely contradicts this claim. In fact, it's not the Palestinians who, both in the form of the Palestine Liberation Organization and in Hamas, have with varying degrees of clarity articulated a willingness to accept a two-state settlement. It's not them that are the obstacle to peace, but rather Israel, backed unilaterally by the world superpower, the United States, which, because it wants to retain its control over the occupied Palestinian West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, has refused at every juncture to concede Palestinian self-determination and statehood, and in fact has resorted often to very violent and brutal military force in order to derail Palestinian diplomatic peace offers. So I start after 1967, when Israel first conquers those occupied Palestinian territories. And I recognize that in the immediate aftermath of that conquest, the Palestine Liberation Organization, at that time headed by Yasser Arafat, initially refused to recognize the state of Israel for obvious reasons. They weren't willing to accept the establishment of a state on 78% of their historic homeland and built upon the displacement and dispossession of their people.
It must have been anti-Semitism.
Yeah, it must have been anti-Semitism, or, you know, maybe just a desire to go back to their homes. But already in January of 1976, as first documented by Noam Chomsky and then detailed by myself recently, already in January of 1976, the Palestine Liberation Organization had come to the recognition that if they wanted to obtain international support for their claims to an independent Palestinian state, they were going to have to, in some form, reconcile them to the reconcile themselves to the reality of this state of Israel. And so in January of 1976, the Palestine Liberation Organization goes to the United Nations Security Council. It endorses a resolution there that basically embodies the terms of what we now call the two-state settlement, land for peace, as well as Palestinian self-determination. And of course, that resolution is promptly vetoed by Washington. And moreover, the state of Israel not only refuses to take to have any part in the debate over the resolution, but also in December of 1975, just before it's tabled, launches airstrikes in South Lebanon against Palestinian refugee camps, killing dozens of people in an act that the United States intelligence recognized had been completely unprovoked. And basically what I then show is that as the 1970s go on, you have this kind of a repetitive cycle take place in 1977, in 79, in 81, and then, of course, most significantly in 1982, the Palestine Liberation Organization makes offers to negotiate a two-state settlement to the conflict, and Israel responds with military violence. The U.S., UN, British officials, if you look at the archives, repeatedly acknowledge that, as one of them put it, quote, recognition of the state of Israel by the PLO is the last thing Israel wants, because it might result in international pressure upon Israel to relinquish those occupied territories. And this comes to a head, of course, with Israel's 1982 Lebanon invasion, because in 1981, there's a whole number of pressures that begin to be exerted upon Israel to potentially negotiate with the Palestinians. The PLO adheres to a ceasefire for almost a year. Europe, which up until that point had been unwilling to accept the principle of Palestinian self-determination, for the first time moves in the direction of the international consensus. And the Arab states, writ large, put forward a peace offer known as the Fahd plan, or a peace plan, or on the cusp of adopting it, that too endorses the two-state settlement. As U.S. intelligence at that period of time basically says, across the board, two things are true. One, the Palestine Liberation Organization is willing to accept and recognize Israel, and two, the entire Israeli political spectrum from Labor to Likud are adamantly against it. And so in order to derail this threat of a Palestinian peace offensive, Israel invades Lebanon, kills 15 to 20,000 Palestinians. And as the UK Foreign Secretary Francis Pym puts it at the time, this invasion has nothing to do with the security of Israel's northern border and everything to do with, quote, the elimination of inconvenient Palestinian claims, that is, inconvenient claims to a state alongside the state of Israel. So that's the Palestine Liberation Organization, and we can go on to discuss Hamas, because in essence, the same cycle takes place. That Hamas, once elected in that January 2006 election, offers to negotiate with the state of Israel, and then is responded to not only with that inhuman and illegal blockade, but also with repeated military assaults every time the threat of Hamas peace offers rears its head, continuing straight through till October 6th. And that's more or less the background for the events of October 7th, that Hamas, having had every diplomatic avenue available to it blocked by American and Israeli power, felt that it had no other recourse but to a violent military assault.
On this front, I wanted to show a new headline from an Israeli outlet, which says that Hamas has reiterated its offer of accepting a Palestinian state in the occupied West Bank. But there's a new twist to it, which I from Hamas I haven't seen before. It says this: senior Hamas official, we will disarm if a Palestinian state is established within the 67 borders. In an interview with the AP news agency, Khalil Al-Haya claimed that despite the Hamas charter calling for the destruction of Israel, the organization is interested in joining the PLO and moving forward with a two-state solution. This component here of offering to disarm if a Palestinian state is established within the 67 borders. Cole, is this something new from Hamas, or have they said this before?
Hamas has made a number of different statements over the years, not always with the highest degree of clarity, but nevertheless in the same general direction, in the direction of acceptance of a two-state settlement. The Turkish foreign minister, just this past week as well, stated that he had been meeting with Hamas officials, and that not only in his most recent meeting, but apparently also in previous meetings preceding October 6th, that in those meetings, Hamas officials had articulated that same offer, namely to disarm in the event that a Palestinian state were to be established alongside Israel, and then to pursue perhaps some kind of one-state settlement or other objectives via political means, not through military means. The main problem is that Israel and the United States, as I've already articulated, have no interest whatsoever in reciprocating these kinds of concessions. The moment Hamas was elected in January of 2006, Israel and the US imposed that crushing blockade. And in doing so, Israel actually hopes to keep Hamas in control of Gaza, because doing so provides it with a really convenient dual alibi for refusing to negotiate the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. On the one hand, they can say, well, Hamas is this terrorist organization dedicated to destroying us. And on the other hand, they can say the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is not representative of all Palestinians or all Palestinian territory. Therefore, we can't negotiate with them either. And it's because Hamas then departs from that script and begins to state either that it's willing to enter into a long-term ceasefire with the Israelis in exchange for a Palestinian state, or in some cases that it's even willing to outright recognize Israel, or in some cases that it will it's willing to adopt the two-state settlement as a quote-unquote formula of national consensus, namely that it won't itself recognize Israel, but that it won't object in the event that other Palestinian parties, the PA, negotiate a two-state settlement. Once Hamas begins articulating these things, Israel suddenly has to batter it back into extremism. And it does that in 2006, in June of 2006, and then again, of course, in 2008. Ahmed has an excellent part of his chapter about his personal experiences during that horrific military assault, the beginning of Operation Cast Lead in November of 2008, and so on. So to kind of go back to your question, this is not really that much of a development. Hamas has made statements like this over and over and over again. And what's notable is that for 15 years prior to October 7th, the United States and Israel made no indication, no hint that they were ever willing, even so much as to begin discussions with Hamas over this kind of resolution to the conflict.
That's the key point, right? Like, whatever you think about Hamas, if you have the group saying, we're open to accepting a state within the 6-7 borders, which again, for Palestinians, is a massive compromise. As has already been said, it's 22% of their historic homeland. Rather than engaging with that and trying to see if it could lead somewhere, if the U.S. and Israel really cared about a two-state solution, as the U.S. at least claims to, Hamas was simply not only rebuffed, but actually put under a crippling blockade, making any kind of discussion impossible. So if anybody really cared about the two-state solution, they would have pursued Hamas's shifting positions rather than shunning it and leading us to where we are today.
I want to show a clip of Hamas official Ghazi Hamad, a video of him making a statement. And this is often cited by people who argue against a ceasefire. So let's take a look at this video. We must teach Israel a lesson, and we will do this again and again. The Al-Aqsa flood is just the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth, because we have the determination, the resolve, and the capabilities to fight. We will have to pay a price, yes, and we are ready to pay it. We are called a nation of martyrs, and we are proud to sacrifice martyrs. So yes, that clip, that statement is often used by people who say you can't possibly negotiate with Hamas, you can't possibly call for a ceasefire. What is your response to that argument?
Look, I think there are several things to say. Firstly, Hamas is not a monolithic organization. There are different positions within it, and different spokespeople at different times articulate those different positions. The camp within Hamas that argued for, on the one hand, the promise of diplomatic and other non-violent methods to achieve at minimum an ending of that criminal blockade, and at most a tolerable political settlement of the conflict, their position within the organization understandably took blow after blow when it proved that approach proved unable to overcome unyielding Israeli and US intransigence. Now, after October 7th, there were other statements by leading Hamas officials, even more senior Hamas officials, which took a very different line. So, for example, on November the 1st, Ismail Haniyeh, he gave a televised speech which reaffirmed Hamas's support for initiating negotiations on a two-state solution based on internationally accepted principles. Then there was there were comments by Musa Abu Marzouk, another senior Hamas official. He said, "We said, we want peace, but give us some of our rights. But they didn't let us in. We tried every path. We didn't find one political path to take us out of this morass and free us from occupation." So Ghazi Hamad's comments, I think, and one of the chapters in the book argues, they were deliberately played up and focused on, at any rate in the Israeli press, in order to, as Colt has described, discredit any prospect for a non-violent way out of this catastrophe through negotiations with Hamas. The only other thing I would say about it at this point is I do think that after October 7th, the prospects for a political process, at any rate in the short or media term, have been dramatically reduced. Why? Because Israel's carrying out a genocide. It's carrying out a genocide in Gaza, and that creates bitterness, and that creates hatred. And it's very hard for anyone in a population that's being targeted by a genocidal offensive to argue for coexistence with a state that has consistently refused any prospect of coexistence and is now annihilating the population. And on the other hand, the fact that Hamas was able to penetrate Israel's perimeter that day with such seeming ease and in such numbers, it also emboldened actors within Hamas and other organizations too, to think that actually the military option might be viable, that Israel can be prevailed against on the battlefield. So I do think, unlike the situation leading up to October 7th, when Israel had, as Coulter has described, and as I've said, chance after chance after chance over decades to reach a reasonable resolution of the conflict, the prospect for that now, I do think, is more remote.
Just maybe a related point to what Jamie just said. Let's take that statement made by Ghazi Hamad at face value. Let's say that that's the Hamas position, that we are going to attack Israel. We've attacked Israel on October 7th. We're going to keep doing it. We're going to do it over and over and over again. Of course, Israel's defenders are going to take that statement and say, okay, that is the reason why the only way we can deal with Hamas is to utterly destroy it, wipe it out, right? If you're going to make that the standard for wiping out an organization, then what about the state of Israel? As an Israeli columnist put it at one point, every 2 to 3 years in the state of Israel, we have a war against Gaza. It doesn't matter who's in power, if it's Labor or Likud. Every 2 to 3 years, we devastate them. And not only are they saying it, they've done it. It's an established pattern. In 2006, 2008, 12, 14, 2021, they mow the lawn. They wreak devastation upon the people of Gaza. If Hamas saying, a single Hamas official stating something like that is enough to justify the complete destruction, not just of Hamas, but in practice, of course, the people of Gaza, then why shouldn't the state of Israel be completely destroyed via a military assault? If you're going to apply standards, apply them across the board.
If I might just quote a few Israeli officials, because I think in the years leading up to 2023, leading Israeli officials were quite candid about their doctrine vis-a-vis Gaza, and it merits listening to what they have to say. So if you listen to, for example, Yaakov Amidror, he was the former director of Israel's National Security Council, speaking in 2018, he said, quote, "We have to alternate between military operations in Gaza and the provision of that level of aid which will not make it completely collapse. Then you take Dan Shiftan, as I said, former advisor to multiple Israeli prime ministers. He said, the Gaza problem has no solution. There are a bunch of barbarians there. What we now have to do is to occasionally beat them up and then beat them up again and then beat them up again for the entire foreseeable future. And that way you get a year, 2 years, 3 years of relative quiet, and then you beat them up again. That was Israel's enunciated doctrine and enacted doctrine. And it's not new at all, in fact. I mean, the spectrum of Israeli policy towards Gaza since October 7th, you could say, has spanned expulsion, ethnic cleansing at the more dovish pole, and outright extermination at the more extreme pole. And those two options, they're both longstanding. So if you go back to the 1960s, 68, I think, Moshe Dayan, the famous Israeli defense minister, he said about refugees, Palestinian refugees in Gaza and the West Bank, his proposal was, let's tell them, we don't have a solution. You will carry on living like dogs, and those who wish to leave, let them leave. So that's one pole, that's the dovish pole of Israel's political spectrum when it comes to Gaza. On the more extreme pole, 1978, the chief of staff of the IDF, Rafi Eitan, he said all the Arabs in Gaza, in Ramallah and in Sakhnin, so in the West Bank, in Gaza and inside the borders of Israel, all the Arabs in Gaza are the same and all of them should be killed. So the more dovish end of Israel's policy spectrum vis-a-vis Gaza in the years leading up to 2023 is represented by the equivalent to what Aziz Hamid said. We're going to do this again and again and again until the population leaves or is eliminated.
And the problem here is you guys are doing what we're not allowed to do in the U.S. when discussing Israel-Palestine is treat everybody as equal human beings. It's just presumed that Israelis have more rights than the indigenous people of that land, the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And you provided some wonderful illustrations of that. Ahmed, I wanted to ask you about the impact of the Great March of Return. This is when thousands of Palestinians in Gaza protest nonviolently. They do so with Hamas's support. And so this is an example of Palestinians doing what so many pundits in the U.S. and politicians have always said they should do, which is be nonviolent. Why can't there be a Palestinian Gandhi? It's been a very common refrain. And what does Israel do? It guns them down with U.S. weaponry, targeting innocent civilians, targeting disabled people, killing medics, all sorts of horrors. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that and what the impact you think was on Gaza and on the sort of inevitable, like whether the Great March of Return sort of made it inevitable that something like October 7th would happen.
I was there at the March of Return, and I'm friends with the organizer of the March of Return, Ahmed Abu Tema, who is a poet, who's a Palestinian writer and poet. And the whole idea of the March of Return started after a post that he wrote on Facebook saying that why can't we Palestinians in hundreds of thousands go and protest peacefully by the fence between Israel and Gaza and call for our right of return. And then what Israel did in response is killing and shooting these Palestinians. And I was there and I saw with my own eyes civilians and kids and children getting shot in the head and in the ankles and in their limbs and getting amputated for participating in the peaceful March of Return. The problem is that it's not that we don't have a Gandhi, the problem is that we don't have someone who calls for peace. Ahmed Abu Tema is one of the most lovely people that I've met and who organized the March of Return, and he has called for peaceful resistance, peaceful existence, the one-set solution, lovely solutions, and all of that. And what happened then? Israel in this war targeted him and bombed him and bombed his family. Luckily, he survived, but he lost his kid in this war. The problem with the West, and I have to say this, please forgive me. The problem with the West is that the West is not neutral when it comes to Israel-Palestine. They are part of the problem. You are part of the problem. The American government and the British government and the EU are part of the problem. They are on the side of Israel. They don't want to see the Palestinians united and calling for peace and all of that. They want the Palestinians to be ethnically cleansed. That's the harsh reality. This is what we're dealing with. You were talking about Ghazi Hamad's comments now, and you say that the question, your question was, what do we say to those who call for, who don't call for a ceasefire because of Ghazi Hamad said? I believe those people who don't call for a ceasefire because of what Ghazi Hamad said are racist. They're sheer racists, because we all know that Hamas don't have the power. They can't annihilate Israel. They don't have the power. The worst thing they did is the 7th of October, in which they killed 1,000 people, which is, I would never argue or call for attacking civilians. But this is the worst that they can do. But we know that Israel is a nuclear power. They can annihilate the Palestinian people, and they have been annihilating the Palestinian people, and they are annihilating the Palestinian people. They are committing a genocide against the Palestinian people. They're not committing a genocide against Hamas members, the fighters of Hamas. They are doing a genocide against the children in Gaza, the women, the kids, the hospitals, the education centers. Everything in Gaza is under the Israeli bombardment, under the Israeli targeting. So just for hearing a statement by a Hamas member who's a lunatic or whatever, you call for continuing the genocide. If you say that, then you're sheer racist, and I don't apologize for that. And the problem is that we are having some governments here or there who are supporting Israel with everything it needs, with the weapon, with the money, with the diplomatic cover, with Western media, knowing that Israel is committing a genocide against the people who they occupy, against the people who besiege. So this is part of the problem. And we have to call these people out. There's the British government and the American government and the EU government, they are part of the problem. They're not a neutral. And yes, the Palestinian people decided to do the March of Return because we are sick and tired of the situation. We are sick and tired of the besiegement. We're sick and tired of the armed resistance. So we wanted to try something peaceful. For 2 years, the Palestinians were protesting in tens of thousands, calling for their rights, their legitimate rights of return, which is guaranteed by the UN. By the UN Resolution 192, and the breaking the siege, that collective punishment on the Palestinian people. We have been doing that for 2 years, every week. And Hamas did not only support that, all the Palestinian factions supported that, all the Palestinian non-governmental organizations supported that. The tribes, everyone supported that. They all called for a peaceful resistance, protesting. It's what civil people do. And what Israel did? Shooting them, killing them. More than 300 people were killed, and we haven't seen what the Western government did. They supported Israel, and they called these peaceful protesters and peaceful protesting clashes and riots and whatever. Why? Because they are part of the problem. The Western media is part of the problem. These governments are part of the problem. They're siding with Israel. They're making it clear. They're saying it clearly and loudly. They stand with Israel. So no matter what we do, no matter what we did, we will never succeed, because we are fighting the entire universe, the entire world. And who are we? A group of besieged people who are like half of us are children. And then when Israel is attacking us, they're attacking our children. My family, 14 kids were killed in my family. So those who don't call for a ceasefire, they are calling for the annihilation of my people, of my family, of the kids, the children. And I can't stand that anymore. If you don't call for a ceasefire right now, after everything you have seen in the past 6 months, then you are a racist.
In the Western media, you'll often hear it said that if Israelis have hardened their hearts to the Palestinians, it's because of the events of October 7th, right? So if you bring up statistics or polling data like the following, that 90% of Israeli Jews, according to multiple polls, believe that the state of Israel is either using enough or not enough force against the Palestinians in Gaza right now. Or if you point out that, for example, the Israeli president, Isaac Herzog, declared, right, that there are no innocents in Gaza, right? You're told, well, look at October 7th. How could you possibly expect Israelis to react differently? Right. But that's really belied by the Great March of Return. Because look at the Great March of Return and you look at the polling data during that period. 90% of Israeli Jews during the Great March of Return, the same number, 90% thought that the Israeli Defense Forces were using not enough or the right amount of force when they systematically gunned down unarmed, nonviolent Palestinian protesters for months at a time. And if you look at the statement of the Israeli defense minister at that time, Avigdor Lieberman, what did he say? He said, well, we're justified in doing this. Why? Because, quote, there are no innocents in Gaza. It's the same attitudes. It's not a result of October 7th. Of course, Israeli rage has intensified since October 7th, but the same basic attitude towards Palestinians has always been the same. This is a state that is committed to, as B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights organization, put it, they are committed to a regime of Jewish supremacy from the river to the sea, and they regard Palestinians, on the whole, as subhumans who should just be resigned to their fate. As Jamie put it, quoting Moshe Dayan, right, the Palestinians should know we're going to treat them like dogs, and those who wish to leave, they can leave. And that's just how things are going to be.
And Ahmed, I want to know what your vision is. What do you envision for the future of this region? What kind of world would you like to see? What kind of political organization would you like to see? One state? And if so, what would that look like?
We don't have the luxury now to talk about a one state or two state solution. I just want people to be free. Simple as that. I want people to be free. I don't want to see colonization. I don't want to see settler colonization. I don't want to see occupation. I don't want to see besiegement. I don't want to see bombardment. I don't want to see kids like my family members being killed and bombed. I don't want to see hospitals destroyed. I just want freedom and equality to prevail. This is all I call for. And I don't care what they call it, one state solution, two state solution, a million state solutions, a confederate. I don't care. I just want my people to be free and only free. That's a simple answer.
And as we wrap, I'm curious for all your comments on what we're seeing right now in the U.S., this wave of campus protests and the harsh reaction. Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu responded to these campus protests by calling for the censorship of U.S. college students.
What's happening on America's college campuses is horrific. Anti-Semitic mobs have taken over leading universities. They call for the annihilation of Israel. They attack Jewish students. They attack Jewish faculty. This is reminiscent of what happened in German universities in the 1930s. It's unconscionable. It has to be stopped. It has to be condemned and condemned unequivocally. But that's not what happened. The response of several university presidents was shameful. Now, fortunately, state, local, federal officials, many of them have responded differently, but there has to be more. More has to be done.
Which speaks to the, I think, two things. The entitlement that Israel leaders feel that they can just weigh in on calling for censorship of in the U.S., which is not their country, but also their fear of actual moral leadership coming from the grassroots, knowing that their genocide campaign in Gaza depends on U.S. support, which is threatened by grassroots protests, such as we're seeing on campus. So as we wrap, I'm curious your comments on these protests and anything more you want to add before we go. And let's start with you, Jamie.
Well, I'll say two things about that. Firstly, I have found the wave of solidarity for the people of Gaza and for basic principles of justice as applied to Gaza around the world and including in the US to be just really inspiring and unprecedented. It's one of those novelties that I mentioned at the outset that the book discusses and which I've noticed is one of the hopeful novel aspects of development since October 7th. The scale of the protests, their resilience in the face of attempts to delegitimize them, discredit them, and now actively repress them has been, a wonder to behold. And I wish everyone participating in them all strength to keep going. I think that I hope and I think that one lesson that might be learned by participants in the protests and others is one that I myself learned in the course of here in the UK. You might have read about it at the time. There was a big multi-year controversy over alleged anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, where weaponized allegations of surging anti-Semitism were used to delegitimize and discredit and ultimately silence voices within the Labour Party and the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, who was supportive of Palestinian rights at the time. That really drove home to me being the target of that kind of weaponized silencing. It drove home for me at the time the importance of free speech as a value. And in the university context of academic freedom, there's really nothing like being targeted. You and your people who agree with you being targeted for suppression on the basis of things like hurt feelings and allegations of weaponized allegations of racism to silence support for justice, to make you realize the value of those principles and why it's so often been the left and dissident movements who have historically fought for them. And I think, and I see, and I hope that the value of those principles in the US academic context on campuses will now also be affirmed and fought for by the activists that are currently being clearly unjustly demonized and suppressed.
I'd just echo Jamie's comments. I too have been immensely inspired by the solidarity being expressed by those university students and their commitment in the face of a great deal of repression to continue on and to stand up for the people of Gaza, despite having no real personal stake in the fate of those people in Gaza. And I also would like to echo what Jamie said about freedom of speech, that the lesson here is that we should be unapologetic defenders of that principle. I'll just maybe finish by saying that Benjamin Netanyahu's comments are so nauseating, in part because we know his favored method of censorship of universities, right? There is not a university left standing in Gaza right now. They've been destroyed. So Netanyahu has sought to silence students and academics in Gaza, and now he's calling upon the United States government to silence their own academics and students, of course, not via the same method, but nevertheless, still nauseating.
I believe these students are not just protesting for Palestine. They're protesting for bigger issues. They're protesting for humanity. They're protesting for human rights. They're protesting for the right to live, for children, right to live. They're protesting against genocide, the worst crime of human history. They're protesting for the end of siege, the end of bombardment, the end of occupation. They're protesting for big moral, ethical issues. And I want to see more protests in the US, and I want to see more protests and more encampment in the UK as well, and everywhere in the world, because we are witnessing a genocide. Some thousands of children are being slaughtered in Gaza. Thousands of people are being slaughtered in Gaza. And these people, the people who are in Gaza, deserve to live. And people here and there in America have the right to protest. They have the right to encamp. And I support them. They inspire me, and I want to see more of them. And I want to say just one final thing. There's no going back for Israel now. The world, the humanity, people here and there are good, despite the governments. They are good. They have good intentions. And once they see the truth, and once they have seen what is going on to their fellow human beings in Gaza, they will not stand still. They will protest. They will express their anger. They will express their frustration. And I believe it might take a year or two or a lifetime, but there is no going back for Israel right now. People have exposed them. They are exposed.
The book is called Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm. Jamie, Ahmed, Coulter, thank you so much for this book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And once again, the book is called Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm. A little behind the scenes, we had to re-record me saying that title several times because I couldn't pronounce Cataclysm, but I've got it It's in the brain.
You also said deluge instead of deluge, which is interesting.
I said deluge.
Yeah, deluge, yeah.
But it's deluge.
Yeah, deluge, yeah. Yeah. So anyway. But you got it right this time, yeah.
I did. I apologize to my Eastlytics colleagues for being so unable to speak and losing my English sometimes. It happens, I guess. And but seriously, very grateful to Coulter, Jamie, and Ahmed for joining us. That was a really great discussion. And it's a wonderful book.
It really is.
It provides so much important context to understanding what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I even blurbed it. Eye-opening, compelling, required reading. God, I'm so good at blurbs. Just kidding. And Norman Finkelstein also contributes to it. Avi Schleim, Muin Rabbani, a bunch of great people. Sarah Roy.
I'd love to blurb your blurbs, Katie, but I just don't have the skills you do to do blurbs. But
I'll teach you how.
Yeah. Yeah. I would call your blurbs eye-opening and compelling.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Yes. But go pick up a copy of Deluge. It's available everywhere. And also go to usefulidiotspodcast.com to support the show, keep it going, and get bonus content.
This week, our subscribers are, of course, going to get Thursday Throwdown, but the full interview is available to everyone. We didn't want to paywall any of it because we think it's a really important conversation, and also because it's really important to amplify and elevate Palestinian voices, and Ahmed's story is really important. So we wanted to make sure that everyone could hear it. But thank you for your support, and we know that you will enjoy the Thursday Throwdown.
All right. That's Useful Idiots. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.